We're going to pause here for a moment of prayerful meditation. So as you're seated or finding a place to stand or sit, be aware of how your body is resting in your chair. Maybe you're going to put your feet flat on the ground, on this floor. Maybe you're going to sit up straighter. Maybe you'll remain as you are. And as you think these things, recognize that these thoughts are happening in your brain. They're coming from your brain, which is located in your head. We don't think through our elbows. But drawing your attention to your thoughts, maybe you'll close your eyes or find a spot on the floor to steady your gaze. And take a deep inhale. Breathe in. And hold that breath, and then exhale. Let it go. And continue that pattern of deep inhale, hold, exhale, clear all the air out. And as your thoughts continue to rise and fall, recognize them without judgment. If you become distracted, recognize it without judgment and bring your focus back. Recognizing that our thoughts are occurring in our brains, and that's located in our bodies, and our bodies are seated in chairs or standing in this room. This room is Roots Brew Shop. And Roots Brew Shop is located at 600 Seward Street Southeast in Grand Rapids. And that's located on the west side of Grand Rapids. And Grand Rapids is a city that's located on the west side of the state of Michigan. And Michigan is located in the Midwest. And as you see this and recognize the space of where you are in the Midwest, which is a section of the United States. There are cars buzzing, planes flying, and people going to and from locations. And you are here. And we're in the United States, which is a part of a continent, and that continent is a part of the earth. And the earth is made up of land and water. And if you zoom out a little bit farther, that earth is part of a solar system, and we can see planets revolving around the sun. And those planets are in the universe. In the universe, there's infinite space. And as you think about that and think about the delicate connectiveness of all of this and the universe and the peace and the silence and the quietness of that, hold on to that for a moment. And take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. And as you see the universe and all the planets and galaxies, focus back in on Earth. Find Earth, find our continent. Find our country here where we are in the United States. And as you go into the United States, look at the Midwest, and there you'll find the state of Michigan. And in the state of Michigan, on the west side of that state, there's a city called Grand Rapids. And in the city of Grand Rapids, there is a coffee shop called Roots Brew Shop. And Roots Brew Shop is currently where you are. Be present in this moment. Recognize that there is nothing for you to do or that you have to do. Be still. Take one last deep breath in, your biggest breath of the day, and exhale.
Open your eyes if you haven't. That's happened to us a couple times here. So again, my name is Nick. Glad you're here. I bet you I'm as excited as anyone in this room is that Kent's here this morning. And I mean that sincerely. In 2004, 2005, I had no idea who you were. And I told Kent, I went on a study tour with him in 2006. And I remember getting off the plane in Tel Aviv and walking outside. I had no idea what he looked like. I didn't know any of your story. I just knew that I'd found these podcasts online, and you had done this series on religious sex. SECTS. I suppose there's another one in you, maybe. But and I remember getting off, and I thought, wow, I thought he'd be a lot older. And I think that's often how people might feel when they get a chance to hear what Kent has to say, because he seems to be so honest. And often, like young people like us, aren't honest about what we're really thinking or feeling. And so, man, I just couldn't be more excited about it. So, Kent has written commentary for the NIV Study Bible. It's the Bible that I use. It's the Bible that I use daily. If you don't have that, like, you should honestly pick it up. It's absolutely dynamite. I bought one for my wife for Christmas even. Like, that's how much it meant to me. She's not as excited about it as I am. Sorry. He's written this book recently, Bitten by a Camel. It's just so funny, and it's so honest. And so, Kent, will you come up and just share with us for a bit? Thanks for being here. Will you guys give Kent a little clap?
Well, I'm going to use this thing here. Well, I feel very grateful to be here. A lot of people are standing. Hey, there are, if I say come sit here in the front and no one moves, then it's going to be really awkward. But feel free to come down these aisles and sit behind me. It won't freak me out if you don't want to stand. So I'm very excited to be here. What a unusual and life-giving vibe this place. See? It's not as awkward if people just do it. Yeah. there's seats here, there, back there. This is good. You get a booth. Yeah, you get a booth. Yeah. I'll take your order in a minute. And here we are. We sang in Arabic this morning, and in Hebrew, and in English, in the King's English. So what a joy to be with all of you. And I wrote a book recently, Bitten by a Camel. I hope you will buy it. I hope you'll buy hundreds and hundreds of copies. My publisher is very small, so, I'm just really grateful when people buy it and read it and talk to me about it. It's not available in bookstores everywhere, like big time books. It's just on Amazon and a few other local places. So, I've been giving little talks on this book, or readings, I guess, talk readings. And I will get to the book, but because I have more than 20 minutes, I want to explore some other things, because it's strange to go around and give a little stump speech like, hey, you should buy my book. Why? and in light of all the madness in our country, and it is a kind of madness, there's a kind of sickness, and it's disorienting. And, part of me just thinks, what is going on? And the word that I keep thinking about is the word lament. That's the word. Like, when I was thinking about the rhetoric and what happened in Charlottesville and the supposed massive divisions in our country, I kept thinking about the word lament. Lament. What is a lament? Because I felt like I was in that place, and I'm in that place. And a lament is something more than grief. I kind of mean it in the old-fashioned sense of the word, like the biblical sense of the word, where people tear their clothes and throw dust on their heads. That's what I think is in order right now. Throwing dust on our heads to remind us, I suppose, of the stuff which we are all made. we're little dust clumps. And why did they tear their clothes and stuff back in the olden days? I don't know exactly. Maybe the kind of things that we put on, like the clothes we put on, create a certain facade or an image. Like, I don't know, I have on this, I guess I have the professor image right now. I've got I need the patches on my elbows or something. But you tear your clothes because that image isn't true on one level. It's just a an image. And I also think they tore their clothes in Bible times because they were also grieving or lamenting the whole system, the government. If you read the prophets, they're just screaming and wailing and walking around naked and making models of the city and then destroying them. These are acts of different prophets in the Bible. But they're grieving, they're lamenting the state of their own society and their own culture and their own government. And they were particularly upset when governments took advantage of people who were less fortunate. So I think lament is in order. And I'm also a big fan of Joanna Macy. And if you've not heard of her, you can Google that later, sorry. But she says change begins with grief. Like real transformation, real change begins with grief. So that's why I keep thinking about lament. I lament our government. I lament our history, our convoluted, mixed up history. I lament the way history has been told. The stories that we like to hear and the ones we don't want to hear, I lament that. I lament our labels. I lament our racism. I actually think, and you can argue about, you can argue with me later if you want, but not now. Racism is also part of our psychic makeup. Even we're told that babies prefer faces which are similar to theirs. Now, what is that about? Now, racism, I don't mean it in its cultural form, but our propensity to be drawn toward social groups and categories with which we're most comfortable. That's a lovely part of growing up and belongs in, I don't know, junior high. Like if you take the junior high playground, what's it about? It's about, where do I fit in? Who's the biggest? Who's the shortest? Who's the tallest? What color is my skin? Who's going to get picked first? Who's going to get picked last? How do I walk? What are the cool words? What are the cool kids saying? It's called junior high. Our government just happens to be run by psycho-spiritual junior hires. Because that's what seems to be going on. So what I'm saying is that being a human being has its major challenges. And the biggest challenge is in our growing up. So that's what I'm thinking about lament. There are things to lament right now. And I also want to say something else about lament. I was thinking about, have you ever read the book Black Elk Speaks? You should read this book after you read my book. Black Elk Speaks. Black Elk, it was an elder, like a medicine man, was part of the Lakota people. And he witnessed the near decimation of his own people. But somehow lived through it. And his book, Black Elk Speaks, is really just a British anthropologist interviewing him. I don't know if he's an anthropologist, but that's what we'll call him. Interviewing him, but he talks about the vision fast. Maybe you're familiar with this notion, vision fast or vision quest. Again, that's a British anthropologist term. What did they do? These young men typically, although women had their own rites of passage in the Lakota society, but the Lakota would send their men out, boys out, because a couple reasons. One, boys don't grow up very well, as you can tell from the people who are running our government. And they believed that these young people could have a vision for what needs to be done. And they sent them out in times when the village was at its most when the village was suffering, I guess that's the right way to say it. When the village was at its maximum suffering, then the need for a fresh vision was ramped up. So they sent them out and they invited them back, and then they would ask the young men, what did you see? Because they believed, I guess they believed in young people, but they didn't call it the Vision Quest. That's like a, like I said, a British term. And that's like something like, you know, our kind of spiritual but not religious culture, which I guess I'm a part of, would like cling to, like we're all gonna go out on our personal vision quests. But that's not, it was a communal thing. It was meant to give fresh vision to the community. But here's my point. They called it a lament. They did not call it a vision quest. They believed that their young people needed to go out and learn how to grieve and wail and cry. Then they could be adults. So that's the season I think we're in as a country. It is time to grieve and lament and wail and throw dust on our heads and acknowledge just how our society has been built on the backs of major, major injustices, which still exist. So the other thing I've been thinking about the last couple weeks is choice. Like, what role does choice play in our lives? And I don't really have an answer for it. It's just something that is kind of floating around in my head. But one thing I was thinking about was the 12-step program. If anybody's in AA or whatever, I don't remember which number it is, but maybe you've heard the term. At a certain point in the 12-step process, you do a searching moral inventory. You familiar with this? Step 4, thank you. The searching moral inventory. That's called looking at your own shit. That's what it's called. A searching moral inventory. And I'm telling you, we need that. And I mean on the progressive left and on the whatever the right is. A searching moral inventory. And it starts in a personal way. You have to be able to look at your own stuff before you can hope that there's any kind of external change. What's a lot easier is to say that person, that institution, that thing over there is the thing that needs to change. Don't make me do my own searching moral inventory because I might be looking into a very dark black bag that I've been dragging around behind me for a long time. So that's the place I feel I'm also in, searching moral inventory, just as a white, educated, overly educated Irish person. What are the things that I need to turn toward? My own inconsistencies, my own labels and categories, my own propensity to label, judge, my own racism, which is in there, believe it or not. Even though I'm like, you know, on Facebook, I could make myself sound like a super progressive lover of all people, but that's called Facebook. Another word for that is a lie, a massive lie. So a searching moral inventory, if you can't do the inner work. And part of my book is about that. It's about taking a look at things that stopped working for me in a religious sense. And what happened is I discovered very slowly that a wedge had appeared. And the wedge was between what I was supposed to believe and think and what I actually did. How I was actually living. And I kept trying to jump over this chasm, like if I could only get back to the other side, the things I'm supposed to believe and think and do and feel even. But for me, I turned my attention toward this wedge that had appeared. Let me say a few more things. I'm giving like random thoughts kind of talk. I was thinking about Abraham Heschel, this mighty rabbi who died in the 19s or somewhere. But he marched in the civil rights movement. If you look at photographs of Martin Luther King, look at photographs of Martin Luther King sometime, and you'll see a weird Einstein-looking figure with thick glasses. That's Abraham Heschel marching alongside Martin Luther King. He said this. He said, not all are guilty, but all are responsible. So that requires, again, a searching moral inventory. Am I guilty of owning slaves? Depends on how closely you want to look at how they manufacture cell phones in this world. Am I guilty? I don't know, but he says not all are guilty, but all are responsible, so I'm responsible. I'm responsible for the history that brought us to this place, the place that we're in. And it's a season, of taking responsibility instead of a season of blame. And just listen to frickin' politics. It's just, who can I blame? Who can I scapegoat and send them away? Right and left, they do this. It's the same consciousness in both parties most of the time. So it's a little dark. It's a little dark. My talk's now like, oh, a little dark. buy my book, it's a lot happier. Yeah, actually, this reminds me of what Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. The problem with that statement is most people say, they don't want to do the first part, the be part. Be the change you want to see in the world. I just want to see change in the world. I just want it to like be better like the way that I want it to be. But he says, be the change you want to see in the world. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. But all is not lost. A couple weeks ago, I went to an interfaith meal with Bosnian Muslims and Episcopalians and Lutherans. And I thought, this is a weird mixture of people. And even this morning, a bit of a weird mixture of people. And we're singing Hebrew and Arabic. So there's a sense that what's very dark in our country, maybe it's lighter than than gets news coverage. So there's reason to be hopeful. I want to read something that I got from David White. He's my all-time favorite poet. You can buy his book, Fourth in Line After Mine. David White, he wrote something on Facebook, of all places. This is what he said about Charlottesville. He said, despair, hope aside, the great underlying question of our time. So you might want to pay attention now. The great underlying question of our time is whether our human identity, with its mixture of fears and prejudices, that's the truth. Our human identity with its mixture of fear and prejudices, it's true. And courage and generosity. In other words, human beings are complex creatures. There are fears and prejudices, and they come out of hiding, especially in times of anxiety. But there's also tremendous courage and generosity. So shaped, this way he says, whether our human identity shaped by millions of years of pressure and brought to its present domination over the planet. In other words, millions of years of evolutionary pressure has brought us to this place of domination over the planet and its inhabitants through an almost virtuous ability to see itself as separate and superior. That's how. That's why you're sitting in a coffee shop with that La Maestra Italian espresso machine that costs $15,000. Through this almost virtuous ability to believe that we are separate and superior. In other words, we can rise above nature. We can control. We have something in this country called the Department of Natural Resources. What does that tell you? That is domination and superiority. That is separateness. It's not the department of what we are made of, which is actually would be a true statement. It's a resource for our use. That's why we cut tops off mountain tops in West Virginia. Just say this mountain, which by the way, the Appalachian Mountains are older than the Rockies. We don't need. We'll take it because it's a resource. Anyway, not that I have a political opinion on that. So the thing that got us here is a sense of separateness and superiority. It's true. It's in our evolutionary, biological makeup. The question is that the only thing there? And is that the dominant, is that the way forward in the future? So he goes on. The question is, can we overcome this instinctual self, which seemed necessary, tribal prejudices seemed necessary. Can we overcome this instinctual self and survive significant aspects of our own essential nature into a future, this is all one sentence, I'm realizing, into a future that is made by courageous choices? That's what he's asking. All right, so what? We're a mixture of prejudices, instincts, fears, courage, and generosity, yet we have this power of choice now. Into a future that is made by courageous choices and not by our inherited and deeply instinctual fear of the world and others. Deeply instinctual fear of the world and others. So, I don't know why I read you all that, just because that's what's on my mind. And it seems like we're in this kind of place right now. We're in this place right now. And actually, when we sing songs in Arabic and in Hebrew, there's a tiny little ray of hope that says we do not have to be driven mad into our own collective suicide by our instinctual fears and prejudices, our tribalism. It's there, but we don't have to choose to move in that direction, which requires a kind of courage with which most of our leaders seem ill-equipped to encourage us toward. Which reminds me of another question. Where are our elders? That's what I want to know. Where are our freaking elders? How old is Donald Trump? Anyone know? I have no idea. He's 70-something, I think. Let's just say he's an old dude, all right? This, like, you think, be an elder. I saw his picture on Facebook, which was like an unintentional picture, but I don't know why I'm talking so much about politics, but it was Donald Trump, and he had a sea of white males behind him. Now, on the one hand, I was like, this is sad, all right? This is sad. No wonder our country is in such a freaking mess. Where are the women? Where are the minorities, which will soon be the majority? So, but I also saw a sea of old men, and I thought, where are the elders? Where's the wisdom? Instead, it's tribalism, it's fear, it's circling the wagons, and it's scapegoating and blame. Sad. So, they're present. They're in people like David White. They're people in this community. They're probably not on the television screen. God, we need some elders. So what does this have to do with my own story in this book? For one thing, I grew up 45 minutes south of Charlottesville in a town called Lynchburg. And I grew up 20 minutes from Appomattox, where the Civil War ended. I grew up around rebel flags, and Virginia's a weird state because you can't tell if it's a southern state or if it's a northern state. It's just sort of wedged in between. My dad went to UVA in Charlottesville, where all this craziness happened a couple weeks ago. Most of the buildings on the campus, I kid you not, most of the buildings on the campus, the bricks were laid by slaves. It's true. It's a true statement. And I grew up in a world, I've been thinking a lot about race lately. I grew up in a world where my parents, I grew up in fundamentalist Christianity, and they believed that you could not marry, that a black person and a white person could not marry, that it was against God's plan, because black people were considered less than and were under a curse. Now you wonder, like you see stuff on television, you wonder, where did this racism come from? I'm telling you, it's in our freaking religion. Not that you have to stay there. Anyway, I was just thinking about my parents. That was the world they grew up in. And actually, I tend not to think of my parents as very progressive, but they made a choice already in the 1970s, early 80s, to break from that long-held teaching that went back hundreds of years and say, we no longer believe that this is true, that it's somehow a sin for a black person and a white person to be married or whatever. That was like radical. That's a radical act of inclusion. That's a radical act of, like what you were saying, Nick, about belonging rather than you're welcome, you know? That's a radical act of opening toward a much richer kind of belonging. Now, it's a tiny baby step, but it's one that's there nonetheless. So I even see my own evolution, which in part is in the book, you know, the seeds of which my parents planted almost accidentally in their own courageous steps within fundamentalism. Even if that's the only major one they took, that's a major step. It's a major step. So, I grew up in this kind of world. And one of the questions that I guess I'm asking in this book is, do people change? It's like a genuine question I have. Do people change? How do they change? What is the nature of change like? My experience so far is, yes, people change, but it's kind of incredibly slow, like the way the rocks in a riverbed change. They do change, but they change slowly. Every once in a while, maybe there's a radical step here or there, but this kind of like American notion that there are five steps to whatever, and if you just paid $100 and went through the program, then voila, you're good to go, doesn't strike me as true. So part of what I'm describing in this book is my very slow change over 10 years or so. Teilhard says, above all, trust in the slow work of God. Now, Teilhard was a dinosaur bone dude. You call those paleontologists. So he knew all about the slow pressure of evolutionary change. So above all, trust in the slow work of God, for we're always in a hurry to get here or there. That's all I can remember of the quote right now. So I guess I'm saying I'm grateful for my parents, the changes that took place in their own lives. And now I'll talk a bit about the book. There are two major images in the book. The first is the opening story, which I'll not spoil. Well, I'll spoil a little bit, I guess. I moved to Jerusalem in 2003, in part because I was very restless, and I did not feel at home inside Christianity, and I was kind of like in love with Judaism. I was kind of infatuated. Like maybe I was in the wrong religion, which is probably a feeling that some of you have had at certain times in your life. If I could just find the right one, I'd feel at home. So I moved to Israel and pretended to be Jewish for a little while. And my landlord was like a rabbi. He wasn't an actual rabbi, but he was like a rabbi. And he would like take me around. He'd take me to the synagogue and take me like, you know, into the Yiddish neighborhoods for weird festivals. And he would make me wear a kippah and like a white shirt and stuff. And what ended up happening slowly is I start to realize, okay, Judaism is an ethnicity, not just like a religion that you can choose, like a college course. You know, I think I like, you know, physical therapy. I'll go after that. It doesn't work that way. So I started to respect Judaism more, and so my infatuation sort of waned over time. But I went there in part because I thought if I could get close enough to the real thing, the real Jesus, walked where he walked, if I could live in the holiest city, if I could get to the oldest layer of religion, I could find the real deal. The problem was the more I dug, the more confusing it became. And I actually realized that there's no such thing as like, I love it when churches are like, we're going to just do it like they did it in the early church, like, which one? and depending on who you ask, I mean, Paul and Peter didn't even get along. I mean, it's like there were already two churches in the first week that it started. So I guess we shouldn't be alarmed that there are denominations. So there's no such thing, really, as the pure deal. And even with the Old Testament, you know, all those festivals, if we just go back and do it like, you know, like they did it then, the harvest festivals, those are all just pagan ripoffs of agricultural cycles infused with some really rich and interesting monotheistic ideas. So I couldn't really find the real deal. And what happened to me at the end of that is I still was on this genuine quest to find God. And the opening story in the book is me climbing Mount Sinai, not like as a metaphor, but as an actual, the actual Mount Sinai, if there really was a Mount Sinai and blah, 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 to ask God what I should do with my life. Like, what should I do? I'm lost. I just want some direction. Is there even a God? That's the kind of thing I was hoping for. And at the top of the mountain, I was bitten by a camel. So I did not have this revelation I was secretly hoping for. It just didn't come in the form. And actually, that became, I was by such a thing. You'd think I'd be like a great story and I'd come back down and tell all my friends, but I didn't. It's something that had to work on me very slowly over time. I realized that that's what was happening to me, that the places that I had been bitten, in other words, the places where things did not work out, where I felt like a sense of failure, where my beliefs no longer seemed to hold weight, where the Bible was a leaky container spilling out all over the place, only the places that hurt were the places I needed to turn my attention toward instead of trying to bury them, fix them, change them, get over them, get really spiritual. I had to turn my attention toward these places where I had been bitten. So I'll read a little bit of this section. I had to try on all kinds of things. I had to move to Israel. I had to check out Judaism for a while. I had to climb Mount Sinai. I had to get really lost. I had to teach. I had to try on being a scholar. I had to work for the church. I had to be the spiritual answer man. That's what I called being a pastor, the spiritual answer man. I had to climb the ladder of spiritual success all the way up to the mega church. That's not in there. I'm just adding that. But there was a voice that kept quietly saying, leave. Sometimes it was just a sensation in my body. No matter, the call was real. It felt like being drawn out beyond the confines of what I'd known. To take any risk at all, to leave home even a little bit, is just the beginning. It's the beginning of admitting we're looking for something that prepackaged religion, with its glut of answers and certitudes, just isn't delivering. Personally, I was looking for God. I was looking for a more authentic spirituality. I was looking for meaning and a place to call home. I was searching for convictions and ideas that resonated with my own experience and for a few new experiences. I tried to make sense of my evangelical past along the way. At times, I ran full speed away from my past. At other times, I ran toward it. But at first, I did not find what I was looking for. And this is a sign that I had merely started to cross the border. Being bitten by a camel is exactly the pattern of real invitation. Had I received the answers to all my prayers, been given golden tablets of divine instruction, or a ready-made job description, the story couldn't be trusted. Stories where people find exactly what they're looking for can rarely be trusted. Because I felt like a spiritual failure, I had accidentally stumbled onto the fertile ground of real change. I meet people all the time who feel like spiritual failures. This is great news. It means we've started another journey. We're on a larger quest. We're going forth like Abram. I want to stand up and cheer, go for it. The Bible, after all, is full of failures. Moses, a murderer, was running from his past and from his God when he accidentally stumbled onto holy ground. A murderer. By the way, the same guy comes down the mountain with tablets that say, don't murder. It's too good. Jonah was fleeing from his destiny and from God when he was suddenly swallowed up. In other words, he was running. Jacob was escaping from his brother after cheating him out of money when he had the most disturbing dream. The woman caught in adultery, about to be stoned to death by religious authorities, happens to be dragged first before a peasant preacher named Jesus. The profound path starts when things don't work out. Jesus' family, friends, and closest disciples rejected him. Only then did the real path of going down become painfully clear as the real path of change. The Hollywood path of conquest is the opposite of real transformation. Nothing is learned when we win all the time. Which I didn't even have a certain person in mind when I wrote that. But now, nothing is learned when we win all the time. If winning is the storyline, we can pretty much guarantee we're not going to grow up. So that was the beginning of my dismantling. Maybe it started earlier than that, but Jerusalem was like a catalyst, like a fire that sort of spread through my soul to speed up some of this change. The other metaphor in the Bible, or in the book, it's also a Bible. the other metaphor, it comes from Jesus, but I didn't really see it at first. So I owe it to my wife, who sort of pointed this out to me. The other comes from this line from Jesus. This is what he says, if I can remember it. It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. You've heard this? It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God or some other such metaphor that Jesus likes. So what's that mean? That means you should give lots of money to Boomtown, otherwise God won't like
yes.
you.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about that image. I mean, first of all, you don't even know any cultural background, and you can just imagine it in your mind. How is a camel going to fit through the eye of a needle? Seems impossible. Seems like it's not going to work. And there's also a little bit of cultural background data that's helpful here. And that is that cities tended to have two walls, big cities. Like the main city gate with like wood and bronze or whatever, like Lord of the Rings kind of thing, city gate. And then what they called the water gate, which was for coming in and out of the city when you didn't want to open up the big doors, like at night or a situation where it's too dangerous to open the city gates. So they called this passing through the eye of the needle. That's the tradition. They called these little gates the eye of the needle. Why? Because when the camels arrived, they had to take everything off of the back of the camel in order to get it through this narrow passage. And I think that's probably what Jesus has in mind here. So, in other words, if you want to enter the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven or take the next step or transition or change, or you have to take stuff off the back of the camel. In other words, you have to unload the thing, not load it up. And that, for me, was the biggest shift in my own way of being spiritual, because I thought that faith itself was about loading the camel up with the right contents, the right beliefs, the right doctrine statements, the right practices, the right whatever, the right songs, the right prayers. If I could just load up the camel correctly, then I'd be okay for the long haul and life would make sense and I'd be good to go on the thing. But it turns out that that's called the first step, loading the thing up. But Jesus says, and that's the thing that ends up getting in the way of growing up. I'm interpreting him. Or entering the kingdom of heaven. See, Jesus had all the religion he could handle, and so did almost everybody that he's talking to. So he says, if you want to go any further, unload the camel. It's time for everything you think you know about God to come off the back of the camel. Otherwise, it's too heavy. And it can't pass through this narrow passage, which is called unlearning or unknowing or undoing or unraveling That's the nature of this, the second journey of faith, perhaps. That's the journey that I'm on, unloading the camel. And that's partly what my book is about. And I had some very specific things that needed to be unloaded. Like, I'll just read you the chapter titles, or some of them at least. You are not a problem to God. I was taught that from the moment of conception, I was a problem to God. It's called original sin. That's called the version of original sin that I was taught. So that had to come off the back of the camel. I do not think that that's true. From the moment you are conceived, God views you as a problem. And actually, not only are you a problem just by the fact that you're born, you just came into the world by a happy parental drunken accident. Who knows? Here you are. But then you come out of the womb and God says, you're a problem. And not only are you a problem, but you're such a problem that when you die, I'm going to have to torture you for billions of years because you're such a problem. I can't accept that. But that's largely the underlying tenet of certain aspects of Christianity. And of course, magically, they have a magic fix called Jesus' blood that makes all things better. You can ask me about that. You should read my book to see what I say about that. But I don't think you're a problem to God. You are not a problem to God. Nobody is a problem in that sense. Another chapter, worry about the afterlife, afterlife. So if you grew up in evangelical Christianity or some version of thereof, this is like the most important thing, where you're going to go when you die. I just came to see over time that this is not even an important question, and it needed to come off the back of the camel. So chapter 5 is beyond Bible worship. What I realized, I know I have a first century study Bible back there that you should definitely buy, but what I realized is that for a lot of Christians, they're worshiping the Bible and not the thing to which the Bible merely points. And they're bowing down before words and phrases and really their interpretation of words and phrases, even though they won't admit it. It's called Bible worship. And that's something that has to go, in my view. If the camel's going to be any lighter, it had to go for me. Chapter 6, also particularly for the fundamentalists, recovering fundamentalists in the world. Ending end times and coming back to earth. End times was this other like major childhood existential dread that I was around, which is at any moment, a man, I guess Jesus, is going to appear in the clouds and suck us up with his vacuum if we've said the correct prayer and really meant it. And everyone else is just going to, torture will commence for everyone else. That's a major misreading of every single apocalyptic text in the Bible, for one thing. But it also, by the way, is behind even the foundation of America. It really is. Apocalyptic eschatology is behind the notion that we can go and do whatever we want because very soon God's going to fix all things anyway. I heard a congressperson say, well, if global warming is real, God will take care of it. You know, that's apocalyptic eschatology, that a quick wave of the magic God wand and it's all going to be well. So ending end times. Number 7, avoid getting saved. I'll let you read that chapter. Chapter 8 is the wall of a knowable God. What I actually came to discover largely through just some exposure to the more mystical voices inside Christianity was that, here's Aquinas on the matter. He says, the pinnacle, this is Aquinas, the same guy that started the college down the street, sorry. he says, what did he write? The Summa Theologia, which by the way, once he was almost done, this is actually awesome. He was almost done with this magnum opus that has influenced the church as much as Augustine. So you have Augustine and then you have Aquinas, okay? He almost finished it and then said, everything I've written is straw and refused to finish it. So what do? We say, well, we're going to take everything that's straw and turn it into institutional religion. Anyway, he says, the pinnacle of the knowledge of God is to know that we do not know God. The pinnacle of the knowledge of God is to know that we do not know God. That's unloading the camel. That's starting off, loading up, what do I need to know, only to realize, actually, there's some mysterious dimension that is about unknowing. That's the apophatic tradition, if you want to know the technical term for it. Meaning, every statement that we can say that's positive about God, the negative is equally important. So, I'll give you an example. God exists. The apophatic tradition would say God does not exist. Not in any way that we understand existence. The fact that God exists is meaningless. That's the richer mystical tradition that just is buried inside Christianity. It's also in other religions as well, like that Sufi song. Okay? So, I have no idea what time it is because I think my watch is off. Okay. I have an old-fashioned watch that you wind up, which is awesome, but then when you don't, the time is off. So, the pinnacle of the knowledge of God is to know that we do not know God. Let me read you a little section near the end of the book. To tell the truth, as best we can, doubts and misgivings admitted, is exposing but absolutely necessary for growing up. To tell the truth as best we can is necessary for growing up. We tell this truth to ourselves first, before we ever trust it to another. It's a journey that's solitary, like a searching moral inventory is a solitary pursuit, but not one which loneliness has the final word. In fact, I found a lot less loneliness when I started to express my doubts and leave the confines of my religious beliefs and church borders. In other words, I felt a darker loneliness trying to stuff what was naturally coming up than I did when I started getting more honest and real, come what may. I thought I knew, at least a little bit, what the spiritual life was about. That's what paid my bills. But it stopped working. I thought it was about doing spiritual stuff, or talking about spiritual stuff, or believing stuff, the kind I heard about in church or read in spiritual books, like this one. But this is what I've learned. The spiritual life is my actual life. I wish this were more sexy and cool, but it's really that plain. It's not something that we put on or try on or add to our real life. Sure, there are practices like prayer and meditation that can help us reconnect to what's real in our lives, but there's no division between the spiritual and everything else. It's both an earnest prayer on an ancient mountain, which is how the book opens, and the interruption of a singing hillside. The sum total of our experiences and all their messy glory is where we live our spiritual lives. The walls come down between the sacred and the secular. The car ride on the way to church, when we're yelling at our kids to shut up, is just as much our spiritual life as the music we pretend to like when we get there. Except I like the music this morning. This place is different, of course. Who we are right now is enough. The life we're living right now is enough. This is a truth worth fighting for, worth the risk of believing. Many of us are walking out of church in one way or another, or away from the protective shell of our held beliefs, because so many of the messages tell us we're not enough. And as we walk out, we walk straight into the reality of our actual life. We have to learn to trust our real life again, the one we live in our body and spirit and heart. In my view, to touch our raw experience requires passing through the eye of the needle, shedding a few unnecessary beliefs and attachments that protect us from such vulnerability. And the secret to this kind of spirituality is to pay attention to the ordinary. That's all I got to say this morning. Thank you for listening.
So as I was listening to Kent talk and I was thinking about the people in this room that I know, I was thinking that, thanks, man. I was thinking that I bet everyone got their toes stepped on a little bit, right? Like there's probably something, because we're all fundamentalists on some level, right? Like there's something that we hold to tighter than other things. And so here's what would suck. What would suck is if like you heard something that was like, I'm not with him on that. And then you lock in on that instead of understanding like what this conversation is about letting go of whatever it is that you just can't seem to release your grasp with. God, thank you for Sunday mornings like this, and thank you for conversations and songs and moments of meditation that make us aware of where we are, that move us sometimes. And we just pray that whatever it means for us to be on this journey and however it is that you're guiding us, that we would be in touch with that, that we'd be willing to be taken on the journey. So thank you to Kent. Thank you for the new faces that are here. Thank you for the people that make up the community of Boomtown. We're just so privileged to be a community. So we pray this in your name. Amen and amen.